And this is the graduate course on random matrices and free probability that Roland Speicher and I are running this term at the Fields Institute. I think we're going to follow University of Toronto timing, so we'll start at 10 after the hour, end on the hour, take a 10-minute break, and then start again for another 50-minute lecture and stop at 12. It appears that next week there won't be a lecture, but because of the workshop. So, but the later later workshops, it's not clear what's going to happen. So I'll let you know. So the next lecture will be in 2 weeks' time. The course is can be taken for credit. So some of you are graduate students and may want to need to get credits, and at least those coming from Ontario universities, I think, can take the course for credit. If that's the case, you should come and see me and let me know. The way it will be done is there'll be 5 problem sets, and the first one is posted on the course webpage already. And that, on that basis of that, a grade will be calculated. There's going to be course notes, so we're very fortunate at having 2 teaching assistants for this course. The first is Emily Riedemeyer from Queens, maybe, yeah, everybody see Emily there, so she and another Queens student, Jonathan Novak, are going to be taking notes and maybe doing solutions, and so we'll see who's taking the class for credit. There is a book that we're more or less going to follow, and I see that some of the other graduate courses really stole the march on us. They ordered a bunch of copies of the book, but this is a new book by Alexandru Nica and Roland Speicher, just published a year ago, called Lectures on the Combinatorics of Free Probability. I think you can get it for $80. I paid $100 for this one, but I was told I paid too much. On the handout, I put 2 links in, one to Roland's webpage and one to Andrew's webpage. And on their webpages, they have preliminary versions of the book, which contain quite a bit of the material, not all, no exercises and so on, but as far as getting formulas, main theorems, and so on, it's a pretty good substitute for if you don't want to spend the $80 on buying a copy of the book. We're sort of going to follow this book, but in a rather strange way. The random matrices only appear in the end of the book, and we're going to start with random matrices at the beginning because next week is the workshop on random matrices, and I was hoping to give enough of an introduction to random matrices so that if you go to the lectures next week at the workshop, you'll have some idea, a little bit of an idea of what people are talking about. So as far as what we're going to assume you know, we're going to assume very little on the probability side, but a little bit more on the functional analysis side, because we're assuming that people here are sort of in operator algebras and not in probability. So a little bit of probability, just the idea of a random variable, the distribution of a random variable, and independent random variables. And you don't need to know a lot of probability theory to get started in free probability theory, because it's a non-commutative version, just like C-star algebras are a non-commutative version of topology. But ultimately, you do have to go back and understand what goes on in all of those other topology papers, because it turns out to be important in lots of examples. But to get started, you don't need a lot of ordinary probability theory. So the other thing I'll say is that I'm not going to assume any previous knowledge of random matrices or free probability, but sort of maybe that's obvious from what I said already. So maybe I'll just get I guess a bit of pause for questions. So any questions about the program or how things are going to work? Maybe it's Barrett? The notes that Emily is going to type, the plan is, yes, they will post them. The two links, or you can just go to Roland's webpage and find it for yourself, or Andrew's webpage at Waterloo, and they both have quite a few notes from various courses they've taught and stuff. And in fact, Roland has tons of stuff. If you go through and download all that stuff, you'll have more than you want to read. So he's taught a lot of courses, and he's got all his notes up there. So let me say a little bit about the history of random matrices. So as far as I know, the first paper was 1926, so it goes back to early days of quantum mechanics, although it was statisticians, not people doing statistical mechanics or anything like that, that looked at random matrices. And for a long time, only statisticians were ever interested in random matrices. And then in the 50s, physicists started getting interested in random matrices, in particular Eugene Wigner. And then in the 60s, there was a lot of development in the physics side. And in the 80s and the 90s, mathematicians started getting interested. And in recent years, there's been quite a few areas of mathematics that have found random matrices to be useful. Algebraic geometry in a spectacular results in recent years, and classical probability has found interesting applications of random matrices. And there still is a major area in statistics and multivariate analysis. And lots of interesting mathematical questions come out of basic statistical problems. And another area where they've become quite interesting is in various engineering problems, wireless communications, passive sonar, and those are the two main applications where you can observe something and then you want to infer a distribution based on some observations that you make. Like in engineering, they want algorithms. You give them some data and they want curve that will connect those things, and you need some theory to tell you what is a reasonable way to connect the dots. And free probability has made some contributions to that. In the random matrix literature, free probability is a relative latecomer. So free probability started to solve a problem in operator algebras. And it was discovered a few years later by Voiculescu, the originator of free probability, that random matrices are asymptotically free. And what that means is that you can do certain calculations on an algebraic level. If you look at the papers on random matrices, sort of the physics or the statistical papers, what you see are things bristling with exponents and subscripts and weird constants and all kinds of various powers of pi and normalizations, and to work out basic things requires a fair bit of work. You have to pump through a lot of integrals and substitutions, and it's actually pretty hard work. And one of the things that free probability does is you just throw away all those constants. The speed of light is equal to 1. Everything is simplified, and you just count a few things, which is something, so it makes it much more algebraic. There's still an analytical side on, you have to use those theorems about when certain limits converge, but the idea is that once you have these general theorems about when the limits exist, then you just want to calculate, just like you do in calculus. You don't calculate derivatives from scratch every time you want to do something. You use your rules, your algebraic rules. And so free probability gives you those algebraic rules that enable you to simplify the calculations without always going back to the beginning, taking some limits and pushing things through. So I'm going to today I want to talk about a very special class of random matrices called Gaussian random matrices. And Gaussian random matrices are used quite heavily in statistics and engineering because of the central limit theorem. That means it's a reasonable assumption to assume that your variable is normally distributed. So there's lots of other random matrices that are not Gaussian, but for Gaussian ones, you can do exact calculations and they're not too difficult. In the other things, you assume less about your random variable. It's harder to do the calculations. You can't write down such tidy formulas. Quite often in the limit, you get the same answer as you do in the Gaussian case, but you have to work a lot harder to see that. And the nice thing about Gaussian ones is that you can do complete calculations all the way through. It's the simplest one to work with. So today I'm going to talk about Gaussian random matrices. So between now and 11 o'clock, I just want to talk about Gaussian random variables. And then in the second half, I want to prove two theorems about Gaussian random matrices. The first is called Wigner's semicircle law, which tells you about the limiting eigenvalue distribution of these random matrices. And the second is a theorem which will introduce freeness. It will show that independent Gaussian random matrices are asymptotically free. So I'm going to prove that theorem, and then I'll say what freeness means. So I'm going to do it a little bit backwards. In the literature, freeness was defined by Voigt-Koleskiu in the context of von Neumann algebras, and then 7 years later, or 10 years later, depending when you start counting, he discovered asymptotic freeness for independent Gaussian random matrices. So I'm going to turn it backwards and start with Gaussian random matrices as the motivating example. Okay, so let's start with some basics about probability measures. So I'm going to let nu be a probability measure. On the real line, and we'll say that let's just say that the mu has a moment of order k, if t to the k is integrable with respect to nu. Okay, so let's say a little bit about some random variables. The nicest kind of probability measure is one which only has atoms. This is a discrete probability measure. That's the very first kind that you ever do when you're doing calculations with rolling dice or playing cards. But then the next nicest ones are where you have the measure is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue measure and has a density with compact support. Okay, so those are really nice probability measures. Say even a smooth density. Okay, so everything's very nice. But you can't always insist on that because there's one very important measure that doesn't have compact support, and that's the normal distribution or the Gaussian measure, so it doesn't have compact support. But these ones with compact support have moments of all orders because the probability measure. And this function, you've got a probability measure and you're integrating a bounded function against it. The Gauss measure has unbounded support, so supports the whole real line, but it still has moments of all order. And there are measures which don't have any moments. Okay, in the context of operators, I mean, you could say it's like having a compact operator, a bounded operator, or an unbounded operator. And as you assume less and less, your technique has to get fancier to deal with the weakened assumptions. Most of the time, we're just going to assume compactly supported. But we also want results that work in the non-compactly supported, because that's the ghost measure, and that one's quite important. If you have a probability measure, you can define a function, phi of t. This is essentially the Fourier transform. Okay, that's something you can always define for any probability measure, because you're integrating a bounded function against a finite measure. And this is called the characteristic function. Yeah, no, one thing I forgot to mention about the moment thing is that if you have a moment of order k, then you automatically have moments of smaller order. Okay, that's exercise one to verify that. But if you have a fifth moment, then you have fourth, third, second, and so on. So this is more or less the Fourier transform of your measure. Now, having moments corresponds to just ordinary Fourier transform theory, this function smoothness properties. So if you have a fourth moment, if your measure has a fourth moment, then your characteristic function has four derivatives, and so on, and conversely, just by standard Fourier transform theory. Now, one thing that's important but not so obvious is that this function, the log of the characteristic function, is quite useful. And if you assume that you have a few moments, say moments up to order k, you can expand this as a Taylor polynomial plus a remainder. Okay, and I better not, let's say moments up to n. Plus the remainder term, little o of t. And these numbers are called the cumulants. Okay, and there's a relationship between the moments. I didn't give them a letter, but let's call it alpha k. It's the kth moment, and kappa, or k, is the k sub j is the jth cumulant. So if you have five cumulants, that means this function has five derivatives, so you must have five moments. So having five cumulants is the same as having five moments. Now, that's maybe more than we need, because we're going to assume that typically we assume that you have all moments, and therefore you have all cumulants. There's a couple of distributions that don't have any moments or only have a few moments, but they're kind of special, and you just have to deal with that when you get to it. So the second exercise is to find the relationship between these alpha k's and the kj's, between the moments and the cumulants. So I've spelled it out in detail on the handout that's on the web page. Well, it's no longer a handout. It's a webout. So what I did is ask you to find them. So, I mean, the first thing giving too much away to tell you that the first cumulant is equal to the first moment. And the second cumulant is the second moment minus the square of the first moment. Okay, and what you do is you just take the Taylor series expansion for log of 1 plus x, and then plug in your moments. your expansion for your characteristic function. So that's how you to get that. Now, as it goes on, the formulas get pretty messy, but we'll see there's actually a systematic way of writing this down. We won't get to that in this lecture, but in the later lectures we'll see how the partitions, set partitions, can be used to make sense out of these formulas. Okay. So let's talk about a Gaussian random variable. Okay, so that's defined by saying the probability that a random variable is in the interval AB is given by this interval. So A is the mean. Whoops, I've used A. Let's just call it M. It's all right. M is equal to the mean, and sigma squared is equal to the variance.
Because otherwise all those other terms.
Yeah, okay, you're right. This should be, let's see. The question is it t to the n or t to the n plus 1? I think I want t to the...
Well, the question is you want little o or big o.
That's right. Maybe I'll just put t to the n. Divide by t to the n and it goes away. Yeah.
But this is not saying the same. This all depends on n, so it's...
That's right. No, because it might not even be a series, right? We're just assuming you can differentiate k times.
Oh, I mean it's only so n.
So this is just the Taylor series with remainder, right? If you assume a function has a certain number of derivatives, you can write down a polynomial where these k's come from the derivative of the left hand side. And then you have a remainder term, which goes away as t goes to zero. But you don't have any more terms necessarily.
And which is it supposed to be differentiable, the phi or the log phi?
Well, they're the same. I mean, they have the same differentiability properties. Yeah. So. So let's see. So what? Now let's suppose. Okay. The mean is zero, and sigma squared is equal to one. Okay, that's the nicest. That's called the standard normal random variable. And let's calculate the nth moment. Well, you do an integration by parts. And you do that, you get that. So what we have is that e2n minus 1. Okay, you don't even need to do integration by parts to get that the odd moments are zero because you're integrating an odd function from minus infinity to infinity. And the even moments are given by 2n minus 1, 2n minus 3, all the way down to 5 times 3 times 1. Just these... it's like a factorial, except you go down in steps of 2 instead of steps of 1. And since you go down the steps of 2, it's often a notation for that as a double factorial. Now, I want to make a comment about the significance of this number here, because this number has some combinatorial significance, and that turns out to be very useful in simplifying many calculations. So I'm going to make a bit of a digression. So if I take an integer and put square brackets around it, I mean the integers from 1 up to that integer. Okay, so deviation from standard notation, but it's convenient. And P of n is equal to the partitions. Right. Right. Maybe I could use Unix, I would escape. Put a slash in front of it to escape the questioner, so the shell doesn't interpret it as a normal exclamation mark. Okay, so you take the set partitions, or just the partitions of this set. So this just means all ways of writing the integers from 1 up to n as a bunch of disjoint subsets. Okay, and then we put a little subscript 2, this is all pairings. So a pairing just means a partition into blocks of size 2, so n has to be even for any to exist. Okay, and what's the significance of the pairings is that let's try and count the number of these pairings. Well, one has to be paired with something. There's n minus 1 things you compare it with. So there's n minus 1 ways of choosing what one is paired with. Then n minus 2 elements remain. So you take the smallest one of those that remain, and there's n minus 3 ways of choosing what that gets paired with. And so on. And, n is odd, then you'll still come down to a 1. Sorry, if n is even, you'll come down to a 1. But if n is odd, then there are no pairings at all, so the whole thing is 0. So, a number of pairings of 2n is 2n minus 1 factorial, and it's the same as the 2nth mean of a standard normal random variable. Okay, and that's actually going to be quite important in all the calculations that come on. And this leads to something which I hope to get to in a few minutes, called Wick's formula. Which is a formula for calculating moments of products of Gaussian random variables. Now, I didn't know much about Wick until a few days ago, and I wonder if anybody has ever heard of, was a physicist, was at Berkeley for a while and a couple other places, but has anybody ever heard of, anybody know where Wick is from?
That's a wicked question.
Yeah. It turns out his first name is Giancarlo. Is that an Italian, is Wick an Italian name? Yeah, but anyways, he's Italian, died about 8 years ago, I think, but so this, he found this formula, I looked it up, but I... Oh, okay. So his paper that this came from was 1950. Okay, so let me talk about Gaussian vectors. In a way, probably if you think combinatorics is sophisticated enough, you could make that out. So here's the idea. Suppose you start, instead of a random variable, you have a random vector. So in other words, it's an n-tuple of real random variables. And we say this is Gaussian. If we can do something like this, except instead of, taking t squared, we do some inner products in Rn. So if there is a positive definite matrix, so here I mean a self-adjoint matrix whose eigenvalues are all strictly greater than zero. So we want to assume it's invertible, such that if I take any of these random variables, say xi1, xi2, up to xik, I can calculate that expectation integral over Rn. I take ti1, ti2, up to tik, and the i's don't have to be distinct here, it's just any collection of i1 up to ik. And then I take the exponential -1/2 of the inner product of b acting on vector t, inner product with itself, dt, and there's a normalization constant. Looks like that. So that's the definition of a Gaussian vector. The simplest kind of Gaussian vector is to take all the entries independent, and then B is a diagonal matrix. The way I've defined a Gaussian vector, all the means are zero, by the way. But, I mean, you can extend it. So if B is diagonal, that will mean that all, that these random, that the X's are independent, and conversely, and that's exercise number 3. And the entries of B inverse is called the covariance matrix, and the ijth entry is just the covariance of the random variables. So you take xi minus, well, actually I'm assuming the means are zero, so there's, I'm just going to take the expectation of xi with xj. So that's called the covariance matrix. So, so that's a real Gaussian random vector. Now, you could also have a Gaussian one, a complex one, so it's a complex Gaussian random vector. Correct. Yeah. after having been to some statistics meeting and teaching linear algebra, I don't even remember what people say in operator algebra anymore. So positive, that doesn't imply that doesn't assume invertibility, right?
No, because zero is positive.
Yeah. So what if you want to say it's positive and invertible? You'd say positive and invertible.
Well, you could say strictly positive.
Strictly positive, okay. But that isn't that word already used for something else? I don't know. Okay. So if you take the real and imaginary parts, so you make a real one by just taking the real and imaginary parts. Is a real Gaussian random vector. Now, here's a nice way to think of a Gaussian random vector, is that the simplest case is that the entries are all independent. Then the next thing you could do is you could take an independent set and take some some invertible matrix, positive matrix, and take linear combinations. So the idea is that either the vectors are independent, or there's some linear combinations of independent ones. So that's sort of a, I mean, instead of dealing with that formula, that's just another way. Thinking it. So, I mean, the simplest case of a complex Gaussian random variable is you take an independent x1 and x2, and you take x1 plus ix2. That's sort of the simplest. But you might call that a circular one, in the sense that the two axes are more or less, well, that the two variances are the same.
Is it taken for granted that the ordinary Gaussian vector is real value?
That's right, and it seems in the probability and statistics literature, if you don't say anything, then you mean real valued, and if you want complex, you throw that in.
You know why that's true? It's because abbreviation for random variable is RV. But you know, with real value, you have to say RV,
RV. Okay. Now, another little exercise is we want to calculate the moments of a complex Gaussian. And since time is sliding on and it's one of the exercises, let me just tell you the answer. So if you take z to the m and you multiply it by z bar to the n, you get zero if m is not equal to n. And you get m factorial if m equals n. And the fact that this is the number of elements in the permutation group, Sm, again turns out to be very significant for the understanding of the real Gaussian random variables. In the same way, this formula over here. So, in fact, anytime you use a formula like that, you often call it a version of Wick's formula, where you convert something involving these integrals into something combinatorial.
Is it supposed to be obvious, or?
That's an exercise.
Oh, okay. And what about this formula for, conducting formula for number of pairs?
Okay, that's meant to be obvious.
Oh.
Because you say, what is one paired with? Well, there's n minus one things to choose. So, and then there's n minus two guys left over. So you just keep on reducing it.
Well, I would say it's a one pairing.
Well, so you say, well, one has to be paired with something, and how many ways can you choose it? Well, there's n minus one ways to choose that, and then now there's n minus two things left over. You take the smallest element that remains and say, that's got to be paired with something, and away you go.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
If you start with something else than one, you get the same one.
Yeah. Okay, now the last few minutes I want to talk about Wick's formula. So, and then take a break. Okay, so here's the... so here's the theorem. So if you look at Wick's paper, it's hard to find Wick's formula in it because he's doing a lot of things. And so I'm not really certain how he proved it, but here's a fairly simple proof. So assumption: let x1 to xn be a Gaussian random variable. Then the expectation of any product xi1, xi2, xik. So repetitions are allowed. In particular, this contains this formula here, is equal to a sum over all pairings of K. So this is, by this it is meant that if K is odd, this expectation is zero. So there's an implicit assumption here that K is even. And you get this, the sum of all of these things, and I have to explain what that is. Let me define that. So here's some notation. If you take any pairing and any random variables, whatever, let's say you have k of them, I don't care whether they're Gaussian, this just makes sense, whatever. This, so e sub pi will be a k linear functional. And it's defined to be you take for each pair of your pairing, you take, say, Rs, you take xr times xs, and you take the expectation of their product. And you take the product of all of those expectations. So, example, pi equals, say, 1, 4, 2, 5, 3, 6. So this will be a six linear functional. You take 1 and 4, x1 and x4, you multiply them together and take your expectation. You take x2 and x5, take their product and take the expectation of that. And the same for 3 and 6. Okay. So Wick's formula says the expectation of a product is the sum over all ways of pairing them together, just two at a time. Okay, and let's just see how to prove that. Real.
But the complex is real too.
Yep.
So then if Z is real, then E of Z bar is equal to Z, right? Then
yeah.
Even if Z, E of Z to the N to Z to the N is supposed to be in the Z bar.
Right. Can anybody answer George's question? Well, okay, so suppose you have two n z's. Half of them have to be z with no bar, and half of them have to be a z with a bar. And how many pairings are there of that are non-zero? Well, you have to pair a z with a z bar. So one only has n things you can pair it with. There's two n minus one elements in that.
Yeah. X to the 2 n is the defining the ultimate pairing. X is just x to the 2 n.
But this is x plus I y all raised to the nth power, right? So
so x, that's just equal to x.
Just a second. This is x plus I y to the m.
You mean x plus I y is a Gaussian and x is not Gaussian? Is that what you mean?
Say it again.
Well, anyway. Suppose y is zero.
No, y is not allowed to be zero.
But then you mean complex value doesn't include real value.
Yeah, I guess that's right. You can't say, I mean, you get into trouble if you allow y to be zero. I mean, it could be a degenerate Gaussian random vector where one of the components is zero.
Right, now I understand.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, so I was forgetting about the imaginary parts. The imaginary parts can't be zero. They have to be also Gaussian, normalized Gaussian random variable. So this is real and complex is completely different than the kind of physics.
Yeah. This one right here, yeah. This is one for x and y are, yeah. Yeah, so I mean,
like that formula is supposed to stay complex.
No, it's not. It's for not true. And so if x plus I y, if x plus I zero were a complex random variable, according to the definition, then my contradiction would be correct.
Right. Okay, so let me the reason you don't get a contradiction between the factorial here and the double factorial over here, I mean, at first it looks like there is something a little strange. Maybe this is what piqued George's curiosity here, is that one's got a double factorial and the other one has a single factorial. And the difference is, in the complex case, you have to pair a z with a z bar. So even though there's two m elements there, you're not allowed to pair them arbitrarily. And so then the number of possibilities goes way down, and you only get an m factorial instead of a 2m minus 1 double factorial.
Okay, but it's really becoming deep now when you say that the two is related to the two that are complex random variable has twice as many components. That
yeah. Okay, so I'm getting close to break time, so I'm just going to try and finish up the proof of Wick's formula. So the first thing you do is you suppose that the random variables are independent, and then you, to get the general case, you apply orthogonal transformation. Let me just do the case when they're all independent. Okay, so here's what we do. So we're given I1 up to IK, and these are numbers in the set 1 up to n. Okay, so what I'm going to show you in the next 2 minutes is, I think, a very important way of doing the calculations. You can sort of do this in your head and believe it, but it's also good to have an algebraic way of doing the calculation, because then you can do more. You can do fancier things. So here's a little step. You think you have this k tuple of integers. You think of a as a function from k to n. Okay. So instead of thinking of it as a k tuple, just think of it as a function. Okay. And suppose its range is A1 up to AR. Okay, those are the possible numbers that occur in your list of tuples. And you let A sub J to be I inverse of AJ. So those are the places where the function I takes on the value AJ. These are subsets of K, and they form a partition of K, which naturally we call the kernel of I. Okay, so these are the sets where I takes on the value little a1 up to little ar. Okay, and then we can easily write down our formula. Oops, sorry. The expectation of xi1 up to xik is going to be the product of the expectations of x a sub t to the power will be the number of times that a sub t occurs in the list, which is the cardinality of capital A sub t, and t goes from 1 up to r. Okay, now let's just think about why is that. Well, what you've done is you've taken this string and you've grouped it according to the ones that are the same and the ones that are different. The different ones are independent, so the expectation of the product is the product of the expectations. And this is just a little notation of remembering how many times each one of these indices appears. And then we have the formula for each one of these factors. It's just the number of pairings, okay? I guess it's right here. So for each one of these things, this is the same random variable to some power. This is the number of pairings of that set. Now I think I have a little bit of notation for doing that. So,
this x1, x2 up to xik, is that already in itself? Is that still in itself, or is that a Gaussian?
No, it's a product of Gaussians.
Yeah, but I mean, commas, if you put commas in between. If you put commas in between.
Oh, yes, that would still be a Gaussian, yeah.
So it's enough to take k to x1, it's enough to take i1 out and 2 up to ik.
Well, except I want to allow something a little more general. I want to allow the case. Well, okay, I guess I wasn't right to say that was a Gaussian vector as I defined it, because the way I defined it, I assumed that my B was invertible. But if I repeat something, then the B wouldn't be invertible, because I would have two vectors the same.
Why are you repeating something?
Well, because I want a more general formula which allows for repetition. Yeah, so in particular, you could just have one thing repeated k times, and this would give you the formula for the kth moment. Okay, so I'm just about done. Let me see, I don't know where to go next. Okay. Yeah, so all we need to know is how to calculate each one of these things. So the expectation of A sub t to the power of the cardinality of capital A sub t is going to be C to the k over 2 times the number of pairings of A sub t. Right, because we're assuming that all our random variables have mean 0, so the only thing I don't know is the variance. So I'm taking the variance to be C in this example. And once you take care of the variance, then you can use this formula right here. Now this formula assumes the variance is 1, but if you don't assume the variance is 1, then you have to throw in this factor here. But this is the same as the sum of E sub pi of X A sub T X A sub T, where you sum over all pairings of A sub T. Because this is a product of variance. Each one has, we'll give you a power of C, and there's K pairs, so we're going to get C to the K over 2. Well, actually, one of the things that comes out of this formula is that if k is odd, then everything's going to be zero. So we could just, every one of these powers has to be even. If a random variable that appears only an odd number of times, then the expectation of the whole thing's going to be zero. So we just build that into the assumption. So each one of these things is a sum over pairings. And then you take the pairings of A sub T for each T, and that makes a pairing of the whole integers up to N. So what you get is you get a sum of E sub pi's where you get a pairing of K that pi respects the kernel of I. In other words, pi only pairs things that are in the same block of the kernel of I. In other words, it only pairs an element of A1 with itself. And the last step is that if you have a pairing that connects two elements which are independent, their expectation of their product is zero. Because if X and Y are independent and have mean zero, then you have this formula by independence, but the means is zero, so you always get a zero. So if you pair something with it, which is an XI1 with an XI5, and I1 is not equal to I5, then you always get a zero. So that means you don't have to worry about the restricting to the pi's that respect the kernel of I, because the ones that don't just give you a factor of zero. So you can just write this as a sum over all pairings, which is Wick's formula. Okay, so I think I'll stop there and take a 10-minute break. We'll start at 20 after. Sorry for going over time, and then I can answer George's question in the break.
Well, I have another one in the meantime.
So the last part of the lecture, I want to talk about Gaussian random matrices and two things, the Figner's semicircle law and asymptotic freeness. Now, I didn't get as go as fast as I thought I was going to do, so I better be very careful about what I say now. So here we're going to assume that X is an N by N self-adjoint random matrix. With entries Fij, which we'll write as real and imaginary parts, not a good way to write it, sorry. Let me move up. So I'm going to take a n by n self-adjoint random matrix. So that means it's an entry, a matrix whose entries are random variables, Fij, and I'm going to write Fij in real and imaginary parts, Xij plus the square root of minus 1 times Yij. And I assume that if you take the parts on the diagonal, that's x11 up to xnn, and then you take all the parts that lie above the diagonal, the real and imaginary parts, xij, yij, they're all independent. So all the entries are independent as much as possible in a self-adjoint matrix. And they assume they all have mean zero, and the variance of the diagonal entries is 1 over n, and the variance of the off-diagonal entries is 1 over 2n. Okay, or a nice way to express all of that is the expectation of the absolute value of Fij squared is equal to 1 over n. And for that, that's true for all I and j. Okay, that's sort of a combining it into two formulas into one. Okay, well, then we say x is a GUE random matrix. And the GUE stands for Gaussian Unitary Ensemble. And they call it ensemble because typically you have what you've done is you put a measure on the set of self-adjoint matrices. Because this is a function into the n by n complex matrices that are self-adjoint. Oops. Okay. And we started off with the probability space, and we've got a function, so we push the measure forward over here. And we get a measure over on this space here. And you can write down an explicit formula for the measure. the measure looks like this. A constant times e to the minus 1/2 the trace of x squared. Okay, so this space has dimension, real dimension capital N squared. And you take your probability measure over here, and then we've got a this is a special kind of function, and it pushes the measure forward, and that's what the measure that we get over on the space of self-adjoint matrices. Okay. Now here's what we want to do. Is get what's called a genus expansion. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to calculate the expectation of the normalized trace of a power of this matrix. We want to find a nice expression for that. And it turns out, I'll just write down the answer right now. I don't know if I want to test my memory here. So there's got to be. Let's see. So it's going to be. It's going to be k over 2, and a minus 1. All right. Okay. Good. Okay, so I haven't explained. Yeah, okay, I'm going to write it like this for the moment. But, so I haven't, I'll try and explain what these things are right here. But let me just tell you what the importance of this expression here is, that if you want to study what happens to the matrix as to these things as n gets large, then n is only occurs one place on the right hand side. So on the left hand side, it's the size of the matrix, so it's pretty hard to deal with something where the size of the matrix is getting bigger and bigger. But when you want to take a limit as n goes to infinity on the right hand side, there's only one place you have to look at, and it's really simple, because look what happens. All you have to figure out is, where is this exponent positive, negative, and zero? If there's any pi's for whatever this expression means up here for which this is positive, then there is no limit, because it just blows up. So the only time there's going to be a limit is when all the exponents are zero or negative. And if they're all negative, then the limit is zero. So if you want to get a limit, then you have to find exactly the terms for which zero occurs. And now, the thing is, you're summing over a set, but the set K only depends on the exponent here. It has nothing to do with the size of the matrix. So the size of the matrix ceases to be relevant. And you're only worried, so for small values of moments, this is a small set. And you can do those calculations. So the virtue of this genus expansion is that you can do all kinds of limit calculations very, very easily once you find a formula like this for your expectation. Okay, so, and we'll get it by using Wick's formula. So I'm going to cover it up for a moment. Okay, so, just to make this go smoothly, I better read my notes first. Okay. So here's the idea. So you start calculating. So this is going to be 1 over n. Now, a trace of a product, that's easy to calculate, so there's going to be a sum over indices, i1 up to ik, to run from 1 up to capital N, of the expectation fi1, i2, fi2, i3, fik, i1. So remember, when you calculate a trace, you take some you take the sum of the diagonal entries. So the diagonal entries of a product are i1, i1, and then to calculate the product, you sum over all possible things that go in between. Now, these are complex Gaussian random variables. That's fi1, i2, fi2, i3, so on, fik, i1. Now I've really boxed myself in. We have this formula. That this is exactly why we wanted this formula. Unfortunately, this is now going to be a sum. I1 up to ik, going from 1 up to n. The sum over pairings of e sub I of fi1, i2, comma, fik, i1. Okay, so now let's see if we can calculate one of these things. Okay, now this is either going to be 0 or 1 over n to the k over 2. Or n to the minus k over 2. And I'll say you get 0 if pi is incompatible with our k-tuple, i1 up to ik, and I'll say you get this if pi is compatible with our k-tuple. So there's only two possible values. And let me... explain how that goes. Okay, so here's the idea. I take my pairing pi. Okay, now it's going to be a bunch of pairs. R1, S1, R2, S2, and it's a pairing of k, so there's going to be k over 2 pairs. And e sub pi of fi1, i2 up to fik, i1 is going to be the expectation of fi, R1 I R1 plus 1 F I S1 I S1 plus 1 T I R notation is getting a little stretched here. K over 2 I R K over 2 plus 1 F I S K over 2 I S K over 2 plus 1. Okay. Actually, that's not such a good way of writing it. I'll just say here's a better way of doing it. That if you take a pair in pi, what you have to do is you want to look at IR, IR plus 1, and FIS, IS plus 1, and you want to take the expectation of that product. Now, if you have a complex Gaussian random vector, you get zero unless you pair something with its complex conjugate. Okay? So the only way you get something non-zero, so this is zero, unless FIR IR plus 1 is equal to the complex conjugate of FIS IS plus 1. Otherwise, you get zero. So what does that mean? That means, because it came from a self-adjoint matrix, that these two indices must be equal. Right? Because switching the indices means taking the complex conjugate in the self-adjoint matrix. So, i.e., unless I sub R is equal to I sub S plus 1, and I sub S equals I sub R plus 1. Okay, so that's what is meant by compatible. Okay, so we say that pi is compatible with I, and now we're thinking I as a function, just like we did before, if whenever I take a pairing of pi, we have I sub R is equal to I sub S plus 1, and I sub S equals I sub R plus 1. Okay, that's exactly this condition right here, that IR is equal to IS plus 1, and IS equals IR plus 1. Okay, now we want to turn that into something from which you can do calculations. So here's the idea. You let gamma be the permutation. It sends 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, also up to k, and k back to 1. So this is a permutation of k elements that has one cycle. Okay. So it just bumps everything up by 1, and the kth element goes back to the first. And now what you do is you let pi, which you think of as a bunch of these pairs here, be a product of transpositions. So I'm going to think of pi as a pairing and a permutation at the same time. Product of transpositions. So that's the R1, S1, that means those two elements get switched, the second two elements get switched, and so on. So since those are disjoint transpositions, they actually commute. That's not so important right now. But what is important is that pi squared is the identity. because it's a product of things that commute whose square is the identity. So by simple algebra, pi squared. And it doesn't fix any points. So it's a special kind of permutation whose square is equal to the identity and no points are fixed. Okay, and this condition here now can be written algebraically because, look, it says pi of r is equal to s and pi of s is equal to r. If you start with a pairing, then pi just sends r to s and s to r. And so this condition says that I of r is equal to I of gamma of pi of r. Everybody see that? See, look, pi of r is s, and gamma of s is s plus 1. And the other condition says that I of s is equal to I of gamma of pi of s. And that has to be true for every r and s. So it means that I is equal to I composed with gamma composed with pi. So pi is compatible with I if and only if this condition is satisfied. So it's actually suddenly very simple. Okay, so let's go back way over to the left, and what we have is that E sub pi of Fi1, I2, up to Fik, I1, is equal to zero if I is not equal to I composed with gamma composed with pi, and if it is, it's going to be this other expression here, n to the minus k over 2. So this is one of the things you have to do in random matrix calculations is to cut through all of these indices. Otherwise, you go crazy trying to sort things out. This is where the rubber hits the road, so to speak. This is where the details are very, very important. So now we can continue our calculation. So now it's going to be a sum. Well, let's see. It's going to be a sum 1 over n times the sum over all pairings of this E sub pi coming from Wick's formula, I1, I2, Ik, I1. And then I use this formula here, so it's going to be and I forgot the sum over the i's. Thank you. I1 up to ik, and a 1 over capital N in front. So instead, what I'm going to do is switch the order of summation here and sum over pairings. Then sum over the i's, Fi1, I2, Fik, I1. And I either get zero or a certain number. So I just have to count how many times this condition is satisfied. So it's equal to 1 over n times the sum pi a pairing of k times n to the minus k over 2 times the, I want to count the number of functions I going from k up to n that satisfy the condition I is equal to I composed with gamma composed with pi. Okay. Everybody happy with that? Okay, but now what we're saying is I has to be constant on the orbits of this permutation. That's all we're saying. It's a function that's constant on the orbits of the permutation. And on each orbit, it can take on any value it wants, from 1 up to n. So it's just n to the number of orbits. Okay, because in each orbit, it can be any number that's supposed to be a capital N. From 1 up to capital N. And it's no restrictions. And then, now, you can move this over there. That doesn't change. The number of orbits of AB is the same as the number of orbits of BA in the permutation group, and pi is equal to its own inverse. So you get that formula up there. Okay. So that's the genus expansion. Now, there's 10 minutes left, and there's a very important thing undone. So, I'm going to state it, and the rest will be in the notes. And maybe we'll come back and do it in detail later on, but I think I want to state it and get to the definition of freeness. So I better just concentrate on that. Oh, that is the board there. Okay. Okay, so the here I'm just going to go into fact mode. Now, I'll just state some facts, and we'll have to come back and give some explanation later on, or have to read the notes. So, let's look at this exponent that we got. This is always less than or equal to zero. With equality, only when pi is non-crossing. Okay, let me just explain that with a picture. So when you draw the pairs, the lines don't cross. Crossing, let me do one on 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. And the, number of non-crossing pairings is given by a Catalan number. Number of these things, okay, of course, I'm assuming a K is even here. is the Cave-Catalan number. And it also happens to be the kth moment of a certain distribution called the semicircle law. Okay. So the conclusion, the conclusion is that the limit of this thing, let me pull this down, is given by the limiting moment is just given by this formula. So this is called Wigner's semicircle law. So law in probability theory is often used just to mean distribution. And so the thing that's very interesting about this is that this convergence is very rapid. That when you calculate this expectation here, and you draw a graph, it looks very close to a semicircle, even for 20 by 20 matrices. It doesn't take long to converge. It's a fairly rapidly converging expression. Okay, now, let me try and say something about asymptotic freeness, and then I'll stop. Okay, here's the idea. Suppose you take a bunch of matrices, X1 up to XS. They're all these GUE random matrices that we're looking, but the entries are all independent. Okay, so all the entries of X1 are independent from all the other entries. I'll call those independent GUEs. No. Independence means that you take all the diagonal elements of each one and all the real imaginary parts of the upper diagonal ones. You take the union of all those things, and that's an independent set of random variables.
Okay, but then that's pairwise.
No. You can have three random variables, x1, x2, and x3, such that they're pairwise independent, but not as a set. Don't ask me for the example, but it's a standard homework exercise in probability theory.
Is the covariance linearly independent in some
kind? Only in the Gaussian context. As far as I know, it is true in the Gaussian context, but I don't know if it's in any other context. Okay, so here's what you do. You're going to make... Okay, let's give this number a name. Let's call it CK. So I'm going to take this matrix and I'm going to subtract the expectation of this random variable. So I'm going to center it, but only asymptotically. XI1, XI2, XIK, and then I take them to various powers, and for each one I subtract off its asymptotic mean. I multiply them all together, take the trace. This gives me some random variable. And the theorem of Voicalescu is that if I take the expectation of that, and let n go to infinity, I get zero, provided a certain condition is satisfied, and that condition is that I1 is different from I2. I2 is different from I3. And k minus 1 is different from ik. So as long as neighboring elements are different, then you get zero, because you subtracted off this mean, and this thing on itself ought to go to zero. And the point is that these matrices, because of the independence of the entries, don't satisfy any relations. And so there's no way to simplify an expression. In other words, they behave like elements of a free group. And so these matrices are said to have the property that they become asymptotically free. It's a theorem of Voigt-Lescu, 1991, but I haven't proved it yet. Yeah, it's in the notes, and now my time is up, so I'm not really certain how I'll deal with that, but let me just state what freeness is, and then I'll stop. This will just take a minute. So maybe I'll come back and talk about this later on. But suppose you have a unital algebra and a state. So it could be a C-star algebra, a pre-C-star algebra, a von Neumann algebra or something. The topology at the moment isn't so important, and it doesn't have to have an involution. It could be a non-self-adjoint algebra. And suppose you have a bunch of subalgebras, and they're unital. We say that these subalgebras are free with respect to the state if the following condition holds: whenever we have A1 up to AK in our algebra, that they're centered, and that AJ comes from the algebra AI sub J. So each one comes from some subalgebra, and that adjacent elements come from different subalgebras. Whenever these two conditions hold, then phi of the product is zero. Okay, that's Voigt-Lescu's original definition of free. You say that those subalgebras are free with respect to the state phi if this condition is satisfied. And what we've shown is that you take the polynomial algebra generated by each one of these independent random GUEs, then they don't have the freeness property, but they're in the limit, they become free. And so many calculations, if you're only interested in the large n limit, you can go over to assume that you actually have equality here, equals zero, and then you're just doing algebra. And that's the big contribution of free probability, is that it reduces some of these fairly complicated calculations and random matrices to some simple little bits of algebra that you can do very reliably and with confidence that you haven't made a mistake. Okay, that's it.